Are you missing the experience of live music? Well then, tune in to WMFO in Medford on Saturday, September 18th from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. We're here on our 91.5 FM airwaves. You can hear the following musicians: Arthur Nassan, Bird Mancini, Crow Follow, Jennifer Truesdale, Katie Dobbins, Little Billy Lost, Mike O'Brien, Neon Gypsy, Peter Parsec, Roberta Lamb, Scott Damgard, Smitty Smitty, and the Cast Irons. Yes, for a full 4 hours this Saturday, starting at 9 a.m., you'll hear live recorded performances by all these great local artists. Only here on WMFO in Medford, Tufts. Freeform, non-commercial, community radio.
WMFO in Medford, American Half Sound.
You really think that just because you have an idea, it belongs to you?
You ain't never in your life heard a disc jockey come through here like me.
Mixes different quotes of people and a wide variety of songs, very, very freeform, which is the point of WMFO.
Push it right to the edge.
Evolution really is a religion, and it's a horrible one at that. That's why I can't understand Christians who accept evolution. It's a religion of death and suffering.
A planet where apes evolved from men.
I know you like two things I like. Chicken and chicks.
Everyone's entitled to a little confusion in their lives. I practically thrive on it.
Freak sucks.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of this show's producer, WMFO, its staff and management, or Tufts University.
You had the power to be all good, all wise, and all powerful. Why would you make the world you had now?
I don't know. I was really drunk at the time.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answer?
My show, I can do whatever I want, so I am.
I want you to trip like I do.
You are so mercifully free of the ravages of intent.
Where is it? I've never heard any music like this in my life before. And if I ever have, I don't know where I heard it.
Get your own show. Play your own music.
I'm only in layers. Built up on top of one another. Like a sandwich.
Different sounds on top of each other.
Computers can do that?
What do you guys think of plastic sushi?
I think you shouldn't eat it.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastic.
Strawberries.
I am not an animal. I am a human being.
We'll be right back.
Welcome to the Plastic Sushi Strawberries in Time Sound Collage. That's right, it's not just a radio program, it's a sound collage with audio clips from movies, TV shows, documentaries, political speeches, real-world historical events, who knows where, mixed in between and on top of the music, which always needs to somehow match our theme du jour, which in this episode is both a fun and intellectually stimulating theme we'll be exploring, evolution. In this episode, the standard disclaimer from Chuck Yu in the intro about the views expressed not necessarily representing Tufts, WMFO, or even the show's producer, that'd be me, is in full force. We're going to be hearing from both some highly intelligent scientists whose views I wholeheartedly endorse, as well as one crackpot in particular who's just completely and utterly wrong. The lineup in our audio clips from who knows where include the Oxford scientist and evolution evangelist Richard Dawkins, author of so many books, including one that perhaps has made the biggest impact of any book I've ever read on my understanding of the world, The Selfish Gene. Plus, we're also going to be hearing from the neuroscientist, McGill University professor, and Grammy Award-winning record producer, David Levitin. And as far as keeping silly, well, we're going to be hearing bits from the young Earth creationist and founder of the Creation Museum, which brings the Bible to life, supposedly, by showing how dinosaurs and humans, supposedly, really existed together in the Garden of Eden. Ken Ham believes that the Bible is literally true, every word of it, and that evolutionary theory is absolutely wrong, evil, in fact. We began, as we always begin a Plastic Sushi, with some music from Japan. That was Polysix. The song was called Coelacanth is Android. A coelacanth being a kind of fish that was long thought extinct, but turned out not to be. We've got so much great music coming up for you in the next 2 hours, including Devo and the Blue Oyster Cult, and Wendy Carlos. Some 20th century American classical music from Aaron Copland. And we've got Pete Townsend of The Who to sing us a song about evolution. Also some Japanese taiko drumming. Those big drums. And as we do all our genre jumping per our Plastic Sushi requirements, I'm also gonna be mixing in what you might call a bunch of old-timey music. Quite different from the guitar-based, high-energy riffing that you'd get in a Tears of the Gods theme, like Metallurgy or Metal Mania. Because in this episode, we're going back to bring you some of the history of the Scopes Monkey Trial of July 1925 and hear what people thought about evolution back then. Backing me up right now is our featured ambiance album, Soil Festivities by Vangelis. This is Movement One. In the next set, we're going to be hearing Aaron Copland's Party Scene from The Tenderland Suite from his opera. And from the Bryan College Archives, a song called The John Scopes Trial. We're going to be hearing from Richard Dawkins talking about fish, reptiles, and evolution. And Daniel Levitin talking about music and human evolution. As well as that crackpot young earth creationist Ken Ham. And also a bunch of clips from The Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. In this set, we're going to be building up to a big sonic conclusion with Koto and those big Japanese Koto drums. And we're going to start off the set with those big drums as well from another Japanese band called Koto Vortex. Here they are with Honami as we explore evolution here on the Plastic Sushi Strawberries in Time Sound Collage, only on WMFO in Medford. Tufts Freeform, non-commercial, community, and even sometimes educational radio.
Probably aware that the famous Flintstones TV cartoon has dinosaurs and people living at the same time. Now, many evolutionists don't like it at all. You know, they absolutely insist that dinosaurs and people didn't live together. Yet here's this popular cartoon program going around the world, and it has dinosaurs and people right there together. It goes against everything that evolutionists indoctrinate us in about dinosaurs. You see, evolutionists believe that dinosaurs died out about 65 million years ago, and no dinosaur lived at the same time as man. It's a key part of evolutionary belief. But you know what? I believe there's a lot of evidence all around the world that really does connect man with dinosaurs. You know, for example, there are cave paintings done by Native American Indians that show figures that closely resemble dinosaurs. And then there are the dragon legends and many of the dragon descriptions that fit with dinosaurs. And then, of course, there's the record of Behemoth in the Bible. Did man live with dinosaurs? He certainly did. Adam, right alongside dinosaurs.
There's a popular misunderstanding of evolution, which says that fish turned into reptiles, and reptiles turned into mammals. And so somehow we ought to be able to look around the world today and look at our ancestors. We ought to be able to see the intermediate between fish and reptiles, and between reptiles and mammals. We ought to be able to see fish kind of on the way to becoming reptiles. But of course that's not the way it is at all. Fish are modern animals. They're just as modern as we are. They're descended from ancestors, which we're the same. Way back 300 million years ago, there would have been an ancestor, which was the ancestor of modern fish and the ancestor of modern humans. And that ancestor, if you could have been there then, you could have seen the first steps towards the fish, so coming out onto the land and becoming something like an amphibian. But that was a long time ago. You wouldn't expect to see that today. And so quite a lot of the misunderstanding of evolution, I suppose, stems from the fact that people are looking at modern animals and thinking that Darwin has said we're descended from them. Well, we're not. We're not descended from from modern fish, not coming from modern monkeys, not coming from modern apes. They are modern animals just as we are. They are our cousins, they're not our ancestors.
You see, we're on a mission from God.
All the folks in Tennessee are as faithful as can be, and they know the Bible teaches what is right. They believe in God above and His great undying love, and they know they are protected by His might. Then today,
Senator. That's such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher, as a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really are afraid of is me.
What might the first song have been? Where did music come from? Why do we have it? You might think that music is redundant with language, that we wouldn't have to have both. But you know, for music to have existed for so long, though, I think that it had to be providing something different. It's not like we've only had it for a little while. As far as we know, music's been with our species as long as anything else that we have evidence for. So we have this evidence from a variety of sources. If you look at ancient burial sites, some of the oldest artifacts you find in human burial sites are musical instruments, and they're among the most technologically advanced that we find in human burial sites. Even Neanderthal burial sites have things that look like they were musical instruments. Another piece of evidence comes from contemporary pre-literate and pre-industrial societies, so-called primitives, right, that are living in indigenous peoples of South America or of Africa. We always find activity in those primitive parts of the brain that mean like call it a reptilian brain, those parts of the brain that we have in common with all mammals, and indeed with all vertebrates. And we find this activity in response to music, but not to language. So music is activating primitive structures like the cerebellum, the pons, the brainstem, preferentially over language, suggesting at the very least that music's been there as long as language, if not longer. Music is going to be something that gives us something that language doesn't. What might that be? Well, I think there are a few things. One is music is better at communicating emotion than language in many, many cases. Think about the way we experience emotions. Try to imagine the last time you felt pure joy. It's probably unlikely that you felt pure joy any time recently. Life doesn't work that way. I mean, you might have had joy with a tinge of sadness, or joy with a touch of apprehension, or a few sprinkles of how long is this going to last, right? I mean, life gives us these complex mixtures of emotions, a bittersweet feeling rather than pure one thing or another. Language isn't so good at expressing that, but the right chord sequence or the right few notes, and you can be right there. How many times have you had the experience where you didn't know what you were feeling? Recognize that you're out of sorts and you weren't really in a good mood, like putting in the words, and then the right piece of music comes on and you go, yeah, that's it. That's how I feel. And I think the reason that happens is because that's what music is supposed to do. Evolution selected for that feature of music, that it communicates emotions to us so effectively and so efficiently. It also communicates the changing nature of emotions. Rarely the case that a piece of music starts out with one emotional feeling and ends in the same way. In fact, I would argue that if you feel the same way at the end of a song as you felt at the beginning, then that song has been a failure. That's not supposed to happen. I mean songs in the broadest sense. Certainly, if you listen to a symphony and you end up in the same emotional spot you began, you probably don't want to listen to that symphony again. You may swear off that composer. This is music that's not doing the job for you that it was intended to do.
Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
One, two, one, two, three, four. Boy.
St. Luke.
Evolution teaches that man is really the intrusion, and death is really the end of it all. Evolutionists believe that man just happened by accident, and one day even human beings will become extinct, so death will end it all. When people adopt these evolutionary ideas, should we be surprised that many abort babies, which leads to death for millions? People need to adopt the religion of life and commit their lives to the author of life, the creator of all things, the Lord Jesus Christ.
These days, doesn't it? We're all familiar with the concept of evolution, natural selection, survival of the fittest. But at the time that Darwin came up with the idea, it was quite revolutionary. What was it that set him on the path of thinking about these things and coming up with these ideas?
Darwin, as a very young man, was destined for the church. Actually, he was going to become a parson. He failed to become a doctor. His father wanted him to become a doctor, and having failed in that, he couldn't stand the sight of blood. His father thought, well, there's only one thing he can do, he's got to go to the church. So he was sent to Cambridge to study theology. And then, most fortunately, he received an opportunity to go on HMS Beagle, which was a survey ship, which was going to survey mostly the coast of South America, but that ended up going all the way around the world. And the captain, Captain Fitzroy, wanted a gentleman companion to stop him from going mad. So Captain Fitzroy wanted a gentleman of his own class, and so he advertised, and Darwin got the job. And this was the turning point for Darwin, because Darwin went on the Beagle, he suddenly saw Amazonian rainforests, he saw fossils, he saw islands, and he noticed all sorts of things which were beginning to ferment in his mind. He noticed that on islands off the coast of South America, for example, the Galapagos Islands, the animals and plants there were obviously related to mainland South American ones, but they were a bit different. And different islands had different forms on them. And this started to bubble away in Darwin's mind. In other parts of South America, he found fossils. He discovered a number of gigantic, extinct fossil creatures. Some of them in museums are actually Darwin's own specimens. He also, a very big influence on him was that he took with him on the Beagle the book on geology by Charles Lyell, the great geologist of the time. And Lyell was putting forward the notion, which was quite strange, as you say, Paul, it was not familiar to people in those days, that the Earth was extremely old. And Lyell also was advocating the view that in order to understand the way the past is, you study the present, you study the processes that are ever so slowly going on during our own time, erosion, things like that, and you extrapolate back and you explain the way the Earth is formed by assuming that over gigantic eras of time, these same forces were going on. So Darwin was prepared by reading Lyell to understand that the Earth was very, very ancient, which not that many people did at the time. However, he didn't actually tumble to his theory while on the Voyage of Evil. That came later.
Well, quite a lot later, really, wasn't it? Because he returned to England and sort of vanished, I get the impression. He wasn't really heard of again until 1859 with the publication of Origin. What took him so long?
Yes. It's not quite true he wasn't heard of again, but it is true that he waited an awful long time before publishing The Origin in 1859. He was a distinguished scientist. He was elected to the Royal Society. He was a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and other learned societies. He was a well-known scientist because of the specimens that he brought back from the Beagle. His book about the voyage of the Beagle made him famous. However, it is true that he sat on his theory. He first thought of it and he got it really right, and he got it really complete in his mind in the early 1840s. And then, so he waited not quite 20 years, but getting on to 20 years before he went public. Part of that time he spent, I think it was 11 years, he spent studying the taxonomy of barnacles, highly specialized zoological work. All the time he was sitting on this powder keg of a theory. I find it astonishing that he wasn't afraid of being scooped, because it's such a simple idea and such an immensely powerful one that you'd think that he'd have been worried about somebody else coming up with it, as indeed they eventually did in 1858, and Alfred Russel Wallace did.
Dinosaurs in the Garden of Eden? Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry has opened a dinosaur-filled creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, I was once ridiculed on national public television in America for saying that dinosaurs were in Eden. But looking at scripture and science, I believe Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus and all the other kinds of dinosaurs lived happily alongside Adam and Eve. You see, the Bible teaches that there was no death and bloodshed, disease or suffering before Adam sinned. So certainly there couldn't have been dinosaurs dying out millions of years before Adam. And not only this, but God tells us that he made all the kinds of land animals on day 6, the same day he made the first man and woman. So starting with the Bible, it's logical to say dinosaurs lived with Adam and Eve. Now how would people have coped with these great creatures? Well, Before sin, all the animals were vegetarian, which is what Genesis teaches. And there was no violence. It was a perfect world. So Adam and Eve didn't have to fear dinosaurs. You know, because of the influence of evolution, many Christians don't know what to tell their children about dinosaurs. But starting with Genesis, we can understand these fascinating creatures.
We've got so much more to share with you about those mysterious dinosaurs. And one such resource is a video we show inside our museum on the theme of dinosaurs and dragon legends. For some fascinating viewing, and for your gift of any size today, we'll send the DVD off to you. Just call toll-free 1-888-89-ANSWERS or the web answersoffer.org.
Mommy, sing me to sleep.
Sure, sweetie. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. You're a ball of gas that's very far. 32 light years in the sky. 10 parsecs, which is really high. Helium, carbon, and
hydrogen
fuse to make our starry friend. When it enters supernova stage, it explodes with bursts of rays. And if the star's mass is big and bold, it will become a big black hole. And if the star's mass is big and bold, it will become a big black hole.
Thanks, Mom.
By the sixth grade, many girls lose interest in math and science, so it's up to parents to help create a brighter future for them. For some simple ideas, go to girlsgotech.org.
A public service announcement brought to you by Girl Scouts of USA and Ad Council.
You're tuned in to the Plastic Sushi Strawberries in Time Sound Collage here on WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform Non-Commercial Radio. I'm your host, Edward Buchert, and the theme this week is called Evolution. We kicked off the set with a Japanese band called Koto Vortex. That was an excerpt of Honami from the Rough Guide to the Music of Japan. Then we heard something from the Bryan College Archives, the John Scopes Trial, singing about some American history from the Scopes Monkey Trial of July 1925, and what some people thought about it back then. Then we heard from the American 20th century classical composer Aaron Copland. That was the Party Scene, the suite from the opera The Tender Land. Then it was Pete Townsend, guitarist and primary songwriter of The Who, his song, Evolution. And percussion-wise, we went full circle. Back to those big Japanese taiko drums that we started the set off with. Our final song in that set was from the Japanese band Kodo. It was called Intelligent Nobi Katsushi Koi Taiko Tobo Mix. And I found that on Volume 1 of Japan Not For Sale. And then a little piece from that crockpot Ken Ham, Dinosaurs in the Garden of Eden, is most assuredly not a public service message. Unlike the one that followed, Twinkle Twinkle, which most definitely was a public service announcement promoting math and science for girls. Meanwhile, backing us up right now, our ambiance is coming from Vangelis. This is movement 2 of his epic Soil Festivities. I've been mentioning young earth creationists who get their name because they believe that the earth is relatively pretty young, like just a couple of thousands of years old, as opposed to the billions of years that scientists believe it is. And one of the perspectives that they have, because they believe that every word of the Bible is literally true, and they think that science is like that as well. So they look for controversies among scientists and then think that the whole theory can be questioned rather than just refinements of basic mechanisms. So as the theory of evolution developed, there were a lot of things that they didn't know about in the beginning, One example was that they thought that things changed at a constant rate. While evolution does occur over long periods of time, there was a controversy about something called punctuated equilibrium, where sometimes a lot of evolution seems to happen relatively quickly in geological terms. But that's because you have big environmental changes like catastrophes, asteroids hitting the planet, and they make big changes. And that was something that it took scientists a while to work out. But the basic idea is that if you've got variation, selection, and heredity, if you have those, you get evolution. And as Susan Blackmore said, you just can't stop it. It's actually really amazing that a theory introduced more than 160 years ago has proven to be so basically correct, with refinements. Darwin didn't know about Mendel's genetics. Darwin knew nothing about genes or DNA, but all of those, especially the mechanisms of DNA, have proven to be evidence in favor of his theory. Science is a big united body of knowledge. What about all those other things from science that Ken Ham doesn't believe in, like an age of about 4 billion years for the Earth, or evolution of new life forms? Does Ken Ham also not believe in the awesome destructiveness of nuclear weapons? But all of that starts with the rates of radioactive decay of elements and so much modern medicine. How about viruses evolving and mutating into new strains as they do all the time? The creationists try to explain this by saying there's something called microevolution that they can accept. They call the other stuff macroevolution between species. They don't accept that. But that's crazy, because there's not actually a strict line between species. No matter what, though, it's good to hear firsthand the beliefs of others, even or especially if we don't agree with them. It's part of my sound collage philosophy. Coming up in the next set, we're going to be hearing more from Richard Dawkins and Ken Ham. We're going to be mixing that up on top of Wendy Carlos performing a Bach piece, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 in G major. Also, some more historical old-timey music from the Bryant College Archives. Can't make a monkey out of me. Plus, more Japanese music from the Yoshida Brothers. And starting right now, we're going back to the 1960s and the Japanese group sounds band The Spiders with their monkey dance. Here on WMFO in Medford, Duff's Freeform, and even sometimes educational radio.
Yeah. planet where apes evolved from men?
Oh, an atheist, eh?
What understanding did Darwin have of the actual mechanism of evolution by natural selection? How do we account for the variations coming into being in the first place?
Darwin was extremely familiar with artificial selection, with human breeders, breeding dogs, breeding above all pigeons. Darwin was a pigeon fancier. He talked to pigeon fanciers, he kept pigeons. He was familiar with the power of selection in the form of human selection, breeding selection. Selection by breeders. He was familiar with the power of selection to transform a wolf into a Pekingese, a wild rock dove into a pouter pigeon or a tumbler pigeon. Breeds of chickens, breeds of dogs, breeds of cattle, breeds of pigs, cabbages. Darwin knew how powerful selection could be. Everybody knew that. Any farmer, any horticulturist, any pigeon fancier knew how powerful selection. But only Darwin realized
but you didn't have to have a breeder. You didn't have to have a human selector. Nature could do the same thing for a selector. That was Darwin's great insight, and Wallace's great insight. You just simply take the whole story of dog breeding or cattle breeding or pigeon breeding. You just take out the human. Substitute survival, raw survival. The ones that survive are the ones that breed and reproduce. Whereas in the pigeons, the ones that get chosen by the human are the ones that reproduce. The dog breeding, the ones that get chosen to make another dog, are the ones that reproduce. Darwin and Wallace realized that you didn't have to have human breeders. It could all be done, was all done, by nature in the form of survival. That was the explanation, that was the driving force of all biological evolution.
I'm guessing that at the time there wasn't a huge amount of evidence to back up the theory, or at least nothing compared to what we have now. Could you talk us through some of the scientific developments that have been since Darwin's day that support this theory?
Well, in Darwin's time, I mean, such evidence as there was, Darwin himself was largely responsible for gathering it together. That was the difference between Wallace and Darwin. They both had the same idea, but Darwin wrote the book which brought all the evidence together. The evidence that we have today, well, there are fossils, and in Darwin's time, there were fossils, and they were discovered by Darwin himself, but a small fraction of the number of fossils that we have today. And in Darwin's time, people spoke of the missing link. This idea that they could see that humans and chimpanzees resembled each other, but there was no fossil evidence to link them. So this phrase, missing link, is immensely powerful. And lots of people went and say, well, I won't believe it until the missing link is found. And you still hear people saying that, by the way. Well, since that time, as you know, entirely in Africa, and by the way, Darwin was prescient in nominating Africa as the place where these fossils should be looked for, because chimpanzees and gorillas were, he could see, our closest relatives. Since that time, an immense number of fossils have been found both in South Africa and East Africa of intermediates, not between chimpanzees and gorillas, because we're not descended from chimpanzees, but from the common ancestor of chimpanzees. And there's a really good sequence of fossils that was not available to Darwin. Fossils, however, are not the most important evidence. I think even if there wasn't a single fossil anybody had ever found in the world, the evidence for evolution would be entirely secure. Comparative anatomy, and above all, comparative molecular genetics, which Darwin, of course, had absolutely no idea of. All he knew about comparative anatomy. If you look at the resemblances between our two plants, they fall on a wonderful meeting tree, a branching tree. And the branching tree works for all the different things you look at. If you say take molecules, and you construct the tree of resemblance of one molecule like phytoplankton, and you get a tree. And then you construct the tree of resemblance for another molecule, say hemoglobin, and it's the same tree. You do it for a third molecule, and it's the same tree, and so on. And the tree, of course, is, as Darwin would have realized, is a family tree. It's a pedigree.
Buy back my introduction to you.
And the tree, of course, is, as Darwin would have realized, is a family tree. It's a pedigree. And you can do the same not just for molecules, you can do the same for bones, do the same for all sorts of parts of the body. So I think the evidence from comparative anatomy was available to Darwin, comparative biochemistry, we can now add to that. Then there's the evidence from geography, which Darwin was very keen on. I've already alluded to it, actually, the Galapagos Islands, the fact that, well, let's put it in one, to put it in a sentence, the distribution of animals on islands and continents around the world, where islands includes lakes and rivers and hilltops and trees, the distribution of animals on islands and continents is exactly what you would expect if evolution were true. If, on the other hand, say, the animals had all emerged from Noah's Ark, you'd expect to see some kind of a, I don't know, distribution centered around Mount Ararat or something of that sort. Instead of which, what we have, of course, is that if you go to Australia, you find nothing but marsupial mammals. And that's because early on, the mammal fauna was seeded by an ancestral marsupial. And the ancestral marsupial in Australia evolved and radiated into all the forms that we see over here. So there's a marsupial mole, a marsupial rabbit, marsupial herbivores in the form of the various kinds of kangaroos. They're the equivalent of antelopes. Marsupial lion, now extinct. Marsupial wolf, now extinct. Marsupial flying squirrels. Look almost exactly like rodent flying squirrels. So the distribution of animals around the world in continents and islands is precisely what you would expect. Darwin knew about this evidence, but there's a whole lot more since Darwin's time.
When scientists dig up fossils, they attempt to give them a history to explain how the fossils formed.